This is an ABC podcast. This is the WA Country Hour with Belinda Varischetti on ABC Radio WA.
Well, hello there, and a very happy Monday afternoon to you. This hour, we're going to take a look at a new program that's trying to reduce waste in the iron ore industry by recycling those massive mining tyres. We'll get into that very shortly here on the Country Hour. And then a little later in the hour, after the news headlines at 12:30 today, taking a look at Australia's first national climate risk assessment, which is out today. And it has some very sobering projections for the agricultural sector.
Well, we know every single region of Australia, every farming region is already impacted today. And what we're looking at are extremely concerning results. For example, in cities like Perth, manual labour could actually become incredibly dangerous for humans to do for 26 days a year by 2070. And that actually really threatens the productivity and job availability for farmers, contractors and labourers, the people who keep our food supplies and our country going.
Natalie Collard is the CEO of Farmers for Climate Change. You'll hear more from her after 12:30. And also we'll catch up with Dale Park from the local farm group concerned about climate, Ag Zero. The report was released earlier today. I know you would have heard a little bit of it so far, some of the details from it, and I wonder what you make of it and what it means for agriculture. Text through, let me know your thoughts ahead of that conversation on 0448 922 604. Coming up to 12:07 here on the Country Hour. And one of Australia's largest almond companies is interested in purchasing as many as 12,000 hives from Western Australian beekeepers as poor seasonal conditions and the varroa mite devastate healthy bee populations in the eastern states. Representatives from Select Harvest met with industry groups at Gingin, 80 kilometres north of Perth last week, to discuss the availability, the logistics and also the prices. Brendan Fuster is Director of the Bee Industry Council of WA. Brendan, what's the scale of this company wanting to buy all these hives from WA?
Yeah, so a company called Select Harvest, which have about 9,000 hectares of almonds in between South Australia, Victoria and New South Wales, came to visit us looking for beehives supply to do their pollination work for next year.
And what sort of numbers are they looking for? Did they give you an idea?
They were sort of looking for 5,000, but they said during the meeting anywhere up to 12,000 hives is what they require. So they've got a pretty large spectrum there for us to try and fill.
That sounds like a lot, but how, in terms of percentages, how much would 12,000 hives make up of the WA industry?
Yeah, well, 12,000 hives out of our industry, we've only got 50,000 hives in the state. So, you know, we're talking a pretty large percentage. Predominantly, it wouldn't be our hives going over. We'd be making hives up during the year, specifically to send them over there for them to use as pollinators. We'll be selling those bees to them because obviously they can't come back into WA because of our biosecurity protocols.
How realistic is that to be able to come up with that amount, the 12,000 hives, to head east?
Given the time frame now, you know, we've got sort of 10 months to sort of sort ourselves out. Yeah, it would be doable, very doable, I think, from our industry. It's just a matter of the individual companies over here wanting to actually run that as one of the major parts of their business. You know, we're going into more than honey or just local pollination. They'd be building bees to sell. We're already selling live bees into Canada, which goes straight into hives into Canada, which does the same job. They go straight to pollination as soon as they get over there. So we're already doing it, but this would be supplying our local market, which I believe is a pretty good thing to look after our own first.
How many bees go off to Canada?
Well, last year was about 4 tonne of live bees come out of WA, and that was only from three businesses. So if we get everyone involved in this little venture, that it would be quite significant, and we could get a decent amount of numbers up.
What's the interest like?
Yeah, look, it's good. You know, it's certainly sparked a bit of interest within our industry. The meeting here was we had you know some of the guys that were involved or wanting to be involved here at my place, and you know the interest is genuine from all of our beekeepers saying, well, it could be just part of their ongoing business going forward.
What would be the implications of this, though, Brendan, on the local industry if you suddenly find that a lot of the beekeepers are just focused on getting those hives ready for the eastern states?
Yeah, look, as I said, it'd be each individual business coming up with their idea, where this is a part of their business plan and they want to go forward with that, as opposed to, you know, managing or just running for honey, doing packages to the Canada or just do pollination services locally. You can either add it to and do it like in a small way or go whole hog and make that your main part of your business. So
would shoppers notice any difference on the shelves in terms of the availability of local WA honey?
I think shoppers are probably going to notice a bit of an increase now that Varroa is in Australia. I know the hive numbers in New South Wales, or not the hive numbers, but the beekeeper numbers have definitely dropped off. I think the last figure that I heard was around 30%, 15 to 30%, I think, of beekeepers are starting to get out of bees in New South Wales. So that flow-on effect may start to happen in Queensland, Victoria, and now that Varroa is in South Australia, it could happen in all those states. So, you know, bees are a pretty important part of food security and keeping food on the table. So if bee numbers are starting to drop off, beekeeper numbers are starting to drop off, the ferals numbers will drop off. A lot of other industries are going to have to start getting bees in to pollinate their crops as well. Yeah, it's a pretty important part, the little bees that we probably take for granted.
So would you imagine that honey supplies will be low and prices going up?
Yeah, honey supply will certainly suffer a bit from this, I think, because some businesses may just decide to sell bees. Some may look at more pollination services, and then honey will be sort of an add-on at the back end, not being the major player in people's businesses.
This is the Country on the ABC WA. Brendan Fuster is here today. He's a director of the Bee Industry Council of WA. Brendan, why is a big company, a big almond producer like this coming to Western Australia? Aren't there any other options available, like splitting hives, healthy hives in the eastern states, for example?
Yeah, definitely that would be an option to get bees out of your own state. And I'm not saying we're going to, you know, be able to supply forever to the east, but for their businesses, it's been a pretty couple of tough years, especially Victoria and South Australia. So their ability to split hives last year was very difficult. And without more rain, they're going to probably struggle again to do it this year. We need good conditions to be able to split hives as readily as we have been able to. And then you chuck in the Varroa mite, which will knock hive numbers down as well as beekeeper numbers. The longer the WA can keep Varroa free and we can keep these healthy hives, we'll hopefully be able to keep adding to their bee numbers to keep their pollination services running.
How economical is it if they're coming to Western Australia to try and source hives?
Well, that's the golden question. You know, it's whether it becomes viable for us to do it and it's viable for them to buy them in. How long is a piece of string? We don't really know that number, and that's what we're working out at the moment. So we had a meeting with Select Harvest and we hadn't come up with a figure yet. So it's up to the beekeepers over here now to go away now and do their homework and figure out what it will cost them to do it and what they can make a bit of a profit on, and then send that number back.
And would they be trucked over?
Yes, yeah, they'd be trucked over.
And what about concerns supplying the market in the eastern states anyway, considering the Varroa mite situation, sending hives over there, aren't they just going to meet their fate?
Yeah, well, it's management, it's beekeepers is what we need. So, look, Varroa's been around the world for more than 30 years. So, you know, other countries have dealt with it and are dealing with it on a constant basis. So what I'm led to believe, because we haven't got it yet, is that the management becomes a lot more, well, it's more difficult. There's a lot more to do. So you've got added costs. So you've got not only the treatment costs, but you've got all the man hours that it takes to put the treatments in. So it's a big process.
Well, this sounds like an incredible market opportunity for the local bee industry. We don't have Varroa mite in Western Australia, and that's probably a key part of this marketing opportunity. And I know you've set up your camera technology to detect varroa mite at the border with South Australia. That's giving you real artificial intelligence monitoring at the border. What do you need from the state government here, though? We heard from Jackie Jarvis, the Agriculture Minister, saying that DPIRD's got this bee surveillance program. It's got more than 40 sentinel hives from Derby to Esperance, and it's working with your council. DPIRD's working with your council to adopt a digital traceability system for beehives. Is enough work going in here, do you think, Brendan?
Yeah, we would certainly like a little bit more. We would love to get the digital surveillance up and running like they have in sheep and cows and the like. So we would love to get that incorporated into our hives. And we've done a lot of work. The Beekeeping Industry Council of WA has done a lot of work in getting this developed. We just need a little bit more now support from the local government to actually monitor the data.
Do you think they get it, Brendan, how important this is?
I'm not sure. I'd like to believe yes. And look, we need some compliance within our industry. We're pushing for compliance all the time, and we're pushing for this digital traceability. I mean, they're two small things we believe that could really bolster our chances of keeping varroa out for longer. And in a perfect world, we may be able to keep it out forever.
Well, keep me posted. Appreciate you having a chat with us on the Country Hour today.
Thanks, Belinda. Really appreciate it.
Brendan Fuster, he's the director of the Bee Industry Council of Western Australia, and a great new market opportunity by the sounds of things with Australia's largest almond company, Select Harvest, over here in WA. Just seeing the interest in, well, supplying around about 12,000 hives from here in Western Australia to help with the pollination process next year. 16 past 12.
You're part of the Country Hour with Belinda Varaschetti on ABC Local Radio WA.
A facility at the heart of Western Australia's iron ore industry is reducing waste by recycling mining tyres. Now, you know, you've seen these tyres. They are huge, some weigh up to 7 tonne and can cost $50,000 to $60,000 each. At the end of their life, most of them usually end up being buried in the ground. But that's changing. Ashley Batalana runs a recycling facility in Port Hedland called Tyre Cycle and says the response from industry has been positive and they're looking to expand.
Historically, it's been really hard to deal with mining tyres, just the sheer weight and size of them. But I think as mining companies are getting their heads around ESG requirements, they've reached out and they want us to support them on their tyre recycling journey. So we've built this facility geographically located where they can utilise reverse logistics and help them with their recycling aspirations of these mining tyres.
So why Port Hedland? What's the significance of having it here?
Yeah, so Tyre Stewardship Australia have recently done a report which shows how many mining tyres there are in Australia, and it's around 130,000 tonnes, and at least 50,000 tonnes of these are in the Pilbara region. So by being located in Port Hedland, it means that we can utilise reverse logistics, as many of these mining tyres are now imported directly either into Port Hedland or into Dampier, and by these tyres getting transported on specialised cradles to the new mine sites, they can now utilise those cradles with reverse logistics at very little extra cost to the mining companies and come back to the one centre here in Port Hedland.
And by reverse logistics, can you just explain what you mean there?
Yeah, definitely. So these tyres, you know, they're 3 tonne, 3.5 tonne each, some all the way up to 7 tonne. So to transport them, they have specialised cradles on prime movers going out to mine sites, and when they get dropped off, these cradles predominantly are coming back empty. So the mining companies are now using these specialised transport and backloading with the old tyres back to our facility here in Port Hedland.
Okay, so once they get here, what happens? Should we go for a bit of a walk?
Sounds good. So the tyres will come in on these specialised cradles. We'll unload them with our tyre handler, which has got a 16-tonne rating. We bring the tyres into the facility and we do a visual assessment of the tyres, get rid of any foreign contaminants, rocks, bit of iron ore, rebar, steel, etc. And then from there, we'll take them over to our Italian OEM piece of equipment. It's called a T-Rex, where we downsize these mining tyres to 60 to 80 kilo chunks. takes about 45 minutes to process one tyre, pre-cutting down to these chunks, which we then transport to our new facility in East Rockingham, where we give this valuable resource a new lease of life.
Okay, so we're standing in front of this big machine that you called a T-Rex. How common are these machines?
It actually comes from Italy. Salvadori is the manufacturer. So there's not too many in the world. There is some in South America as well, where there's some really good governance around recycling of mining tyres. But yeah, this is the first one in Australia, and this is the first mining tyre dedicated for tyre recycling facility in Australia.
So it gets chopped up into little pieces, someone with a bobcat comes and puts it into a big pile, and then what happens next? Where do they get sent to?
Yeah, so once we've done the pre-processing here of the chunks, we'll then transport this material down to our facility in East Rockingham, and we'll turn those pieces of, you know, 60 to 80 kilo chunks of rubber into all sorts of different materials, getting it all the way down to 30 mesh or 0.7 of a millimetre, which we call rubber crumb, which can be utilised in a variety of different means, but one of the main applications is in roads, in spray seal and asphalt applications.
So up until now, what happened to most mining tyres? Where were they ending up?
Up until now, most mining tyres are being buried on site in pit burial methods. Completely legal, they're completely licensed to do it. But now, with this new facility, the option's there, and we're here to support the mining companies on this journey.
So why would a mining company pay to recycle it instead of just burying it in the ground like they have always done?
Oh, I think in this day and age, the mining companies with their ESG requirements are really looking for circular outcomes. And so that's why they're reaching out to companies like Tyrecycle to get the recycling benefits of their tyres, of this precious resource.
And it's not just mining tyres, is it, that you are looking at recycling here? What's the other material that can be difficult to find a second life for?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And any time you talk mining tyres with mining companies or the OTR tyres, off-the-road tyres, the next question is always about conveyor belt. So we've started taking some conveyor belt up here just recently as well, and helping the mining companies with their recycling aspirations on conveyor belt as well, which is almost as hard, if not harder, to deal with than the mining tyres themselves.
Because conveyor belts, is that because they're really long or...?
Yeah, and just the handling of them. So the mining tyres, they'll get up to 3.5, 5 tonne, maybe 7 tonne most, but some of the big conveyor belt reels, I've seen up to 75 tonne. Predominantly most of them are 25 to 35 tonne. So it's just a lot of different lifting infrastructure needed to process them down to manageable pieces that we can then shred them.
Ashley Batalana is the head of mining, trading and strategic development at Tyrecycle. He was speaking to George Hargreaves at the mining tyre recycling facility that's based at Port Hedland. And if you want to learn more, see some of the photos, see that photo of the T-Rex machine that Ashley was talking about. Just look up Mine Tyres ABC and you'll find George's story. 23 past 12. As always, we'll check in with the news headlines very shortly, and then it's off to the Bureau to have a look at the weather conditions right across the state. First, with just over 2 weeks to go before the Kelpies for Kids auction at the Perth Royal Show, prospective buyers got a chance to see them in action on a Great Southern Farm over the weekend. The 9 dogs have been trained by some of WA's top working dog trainers. The Kelpies for Kids project raises funds and also awareness about country kids spending time away from home while receiving treatment at Perth's Children's Hospital. It's organised by Lake Grace farmer Kate Wilcox.
So today we've got an open day for the community, and we've also got an inspection day for prospective buyers, which are different farmers from around the state that have come to have a look. Just from local farming operations. We've had a great amount of interest from both sheep and cattle operations. I would like to think, with the time that the trainers have put in, I'd like to think that we could get 5,000 a dog, because, yeah, basically the amount of work boots and thongs that puppies chew, you've probably saved that already.
And the space I'm Sophie Wellstead, and this is Clementine Wellstead, who's four, nearly five, and this is Harriet, who's two, and we're Coginut Farmers. We've come to have a look at the dogs working, because we have a few Kelpies ourselves, and the girls wanted to see what all the kids have done, and they were very impressed that kids had trained these dogs and helped train these dogs, and we wanted to learn and potentially have a look to buy too. We don't want anything too pushy, something that can give a bit of space, because we're not really we have hunterways at home that we use in the yards, so we're after a Kelpie for the paddock. But mostly what we're doing, Clementine, Harriet and I, is moving sheep long distances.
Now, it's not a rude question, but what's your budget for a dog? You know, if you were out there looking not for this option, what would you go for?
I was thinking about this driving up, and just with labour now and without a dog, we have a few people working on the farm at the moment, and employees that don't have a dog, it's nearly not worth asking them to move sheep or work with sheep, because it's just such a hard job, especially where we're moving the stock. Like, there's sometimes the fences are not quite good, or there's not laneways, so it's very hard job for one person to do. So putting a figure on a dog, like I've heard, you know, 20 grand put out there, like I probably wouldn't pay that, but I can see how it's 100% you get your return on investment with a dog worth like that, because they can definitely probably do more than what an employee can do sometimes, like with the right person and the right dog, then
Will you go up to the Royal Show to do some bidding, do you think?
Yeah, Clementine and I will be in Perth, so and you too, Harriet. So we'll keep an eye out, and if we see something that we are really impressed with, we'd love to put a bid on and see if we're successful.
I'm Laura Thorne. I farm in Broomhill. We're mixed cropping and livestock, but we run shedders, so more of the meat breed than the merinos.
You're here looking at these dogs which are going to be auctioned at the show. What are you looking for?
I'm not a trained eye, but I like a bit of dog with presence. I'm not big on the bark for me. I like a little bit low stress, but we don't do a lot of in yard, so we're more paddock, and they don't need to be run nearly as much as merinos. So I don't like them too close to the back of the sheep, so a presence is preferred. Normally I'd go border collies, but I've recently jumped ship over to the Kelpies, and no looking back. They're beautiful.
And colours?
I've actually got a blue Kelpie, which it's a different colour altogether, but I don't have a preference. I want a good dog. That's what's most important.
Now, the bidding obviously will be driven to a degree by people wanting to help the Kelpies Kids charity. Do you have a ceiling, or what are you working on?
Oh, I don't actually know, to be honest. This is my first auction, so I just have to see what everyone else is doing. I like Ken Atherton's dog, and I like how Ken trains, so that's the one I'd be looking at. But, and I'm sure people already said this, but the money you save on labour with a really good dog, you can justify anything, really. Yeah.
Daisy Edgerton Wolverton. We're in Franklin River. We're keen to get a dog partially trained. We're lacking dogs at the moment on the farm, so don't really want to go through the puppy stage.
How many sheep would your dog have to handle?
Probably about 8,000 ewes, and we've just lambed, so probably up to about 16,000 at the moment.
So they've got the work cut out?
Yes.
And at the moment you've got an older dog?
Yes, 10-year-old Kelpie. He's been amazing. We had his son, but he was killed earlier this year, which was devastating for us. He was just in his prime. So we're needing another workman, and thought we'd come down and it's for a good cause. So if the money goes to the kids, well, we're prepared to pay. You think about, COVID times, people buying Labradors and things for $5,000-$6,000 during COVID. So a working dog is just worth every penny. So,
and all of these come from good breeding lines.
Very good breeding lines and great trainers. So, prepared to pay for a second workman.
Daisy Edgerton Wolverton from Franklin. She was speaking to Mark Bennett on a farm near Tenterden about 330 kilometres southeast of Perth, and the Kelpies for Kids auction will be in the Sheep Pavilion at the Perth Royal Show on Friday, the 3rd of October, starting at 3 o'clock. And there is a Kelpies for Kids Facebook page, which has all of the updates for you if you'd like to make your way there. 12:30 here on the Country Hour, Jonathan Beale is here with the news headlines. Hello.
Hello, Belinda. The Premier says he's confident the demand for more skilled workers to help build Australia's future defence vessels will be met. The federal government has announced a multi-billion dollar naval construction hub will be built at Henderson, south of Perth. It's expected the facility will require up to 10,000 workers. Roger Cook says attracting and training those workers is a major focus for his government. The Australian Securities and Investments Commission has accused the ANZ Bank of repeatedly betraying the trust of Australians. The bank faces a record $240 million penalty for engaging in unconscionable conduct in some of its bond trading for the federal government and widespread misconduct affecting nearly 65,000 retail customers. ASIC says ANZ has a history of non-compliance in market matters. And the British Prime Minister has responded to a far-right rally in London at the weekend by saying the UK will not allow racial intimidation. More than 110,000 people attended Saturday's anti-immigration march, which police say was marked by unacceptable violence. Sir Keir Starmer says the right to peaceful protest is a core value, but Britain will not stand for assaults on police or people being intimidated because of their skin colour. More news, Belinda, at 1 o'clock.
Thank you so much, Jonathan. 29 to 1.
You're with Belinda Varaschetti on the Country Hour on ABC Local Radio WA.
Shortly taking a look at some of the key findings in Australia's first national climate risk assessment, which was released earlier today by the Climate Change and Energy Minister, Chris Bowen. And when it comes to the agricultural sector and living in rural and regional parts of the state, it seems that from this report, agriculture, outdoor workers and critical infrastructure, things like telecommunications, will all be negatively affected by climate change. So we'll hear from the minister and also talk to a couple of different farming groups in response to that. But keen to hear from you too, 0448 922 604. What do you make of the report, the details that you've heard so far, and what changes are you making at your place, if any? 0448 922 604. 28 to 1. Let's head to the Bureau of Meteorology now. Luke Huntington is with you today. Luke, there was certainly a show on yesterday in parts of the Southwest Land Division. Rain, very strong winds in parts as well. How's it looking this afternoon?
Yeah, hi, Belinda. In the wake of that front that moved through yesterday, we've got the ridge over central parts of the state. So we're still quite in a gusty southwesterly flow over the west and south coast of the Southwest Land Division. But the showers are pushing in through most parts, but they're more likely just along that west and south coast for the remainder of today. So, but only light falls, 1 to 3 millimetres around that west coast, maybe a little bit more. Up to 10 millimetres is still possible around the south coast, and some possible small hail is also on the cards for the south coastal districts, but that's gradually contracting eastwards during today. Through the inland areas, we're only expecting up to a millimetre, if that's through the wheat belt and the Great Southern there. As we head into Tuesday, that ridge slips a little bit further south, but there'll still be the onshore flow south of that with a couple of light showers over probably southern and central parts of the Southwest Land Division, but mostly near the west and south coasts again. So, again, only 1 to 3 millimetres southwest of around Dongara to Albany. And that's pretty much near the coastline. But as you headed further inland into parts of the Great Southern, in the western parts around the sort of the wandering Katanning area, only looking at up to a millimetre. So there's not going to be too much around tomorrow. And we do have another front on the forecast for Wednesday as well. So that'll start coming through the Capes before sunrise and then push its way up to around Perth to Albany by late morning and then up to to probably around Geraldton across to Esperance in the late afternoon and towards evening. So the front has some rainfall, some higher rainfall associated with it. So 5 to 15 millimetres is likely around sort of southwest of Durian Bay across to Northam and then down to Albany. And then some places may even get up to 20 to 25 millimetres in the usual places like along the Darling Scarp there and maybe just along the very far southwestern coastline between Augusta and Albany. Further inland, the rainfall should get in to far western parts of the Great Southern. So you're looking at maybe up to 10 to 15 millimetres around that sort of wandering Katanning area. And then east of there, sort of the Lake Grace, Corrigan area, you're probably looking at 2 to 6 millimetres. For the wheat belt in the southwestern parts, generally 2 to 6 millimetres, so around the Meriden area, Quereding, that sort of area, 2 to 6. And then once you get out to Southern Cross and then up to Del Wallinu, you're only looking at up to a millimetre. And through the central west, Geraldton area into Morowa, that type of area, only up to a millimetre, but down near Durian Bay, Mora area, 2 to 6 millimetres is on the cards. Esperance area, Esperance itself should get around 2 to 6 millimetres, but by the time you get inland towards Salmon Gums, you're only looking at sort of 1 millimetre. And then there's just a chance of some thunderstorms just about the coastline between Windy Harbour and Bremer Bay, just with the front as it moves through. Then heading into Thursday, that front works its way towards the east, and we're back into sort of the onshore flow. Not too much around on Thursday. We do have some showers up to 3 to 8 millimetres along the coastline between Augusta and Bremer Bay, but most of it will be 1 to 2 millimetres around the Esperance coast, and then along the west coast it's mostly going to be 1 to 2 millimetres, and then only up to a millimetre once you get through the inland parts through the southwestern wheat belt and the Great Southern. And Friday probably even less. We've still got a weak cold front brushing the southwest coast late Thursday, and then along the Esperance coast on Friday. So that'll maintain some showers over the southern and central parts of the southwest land division, but looks like only very light falls at this stage.
And how are conditions across northern and eastern parts then, Luke?
Northern and eastern parts, there is a cloud band through the northern south interior at the moment into the southeast Pilbara, but only light falls in that. And then that cloud band weakens tomorrow. So probably during the morning that'll weaken off and the showers will start to clear. And then getting into Wednesday, that front works its way up probably just to the very far southwestern Gascoyne and maybe the far western Eucla, but by the time that gets up to those regions, it's going to be very isolated and very light, so it's only going to be brief. And then as the new ridge pushes in like sort of later in the week, we'll see a return of gusty southeasterly winds to the Pilbara region. So not a whole lot of rain for the northern eastern parts of the state over the next few days. And I'll just jump back for the southwest land division again because I forgot to mention there is a risk of some frost tomorrow morning through the wheat belt and the Great Southern there. So temperatures getting down to 1 or 2 degrees around the Southern Cross northern area, Corrie. So there is that risk of frost tomorrow morning.
Thank you for that, Luke. It is 22 to 1. Richard Hudson in the studio now to take a look at the rainfall figures. And there was a bit about over the weekend.
Yeah, there were. So this is 9 a.m. Friday through to 9 o'clock this morning. Up in the north, not much around in the Kimberley. Drysdale River Station topped it with 3. Nothing in the Pilbara. In the Gascoyne, Steep Point and Williambury had the most with 4 mils. Nothing in the interior, the Goldfields or the Eucla in the southeast. But in the southwest land division, it seemed as though most places got some rain. In the central west, the cutoff point today is 10 mils. That gives you an indication as to how much rain there was. Barberton East, 14. Canterbury, Geraldton Airport and Durian Bay recorded 10. Lancelin Defence, 13. Nambung Station, 10. Eunorsia, 12. Tobraddon, 10. And Wiradjuri East had 24. In the lower west, there was a lot more, so the cutoff is 40 and above. Bickley had 42. Bungendore, 48. Dwelling Up, 45. Gleneagle, 56. Jarrodale, 55. Carnot, 51. Carrigella North, 48. Mount Solis, 54. Mundaring, 53. In the southwest, it's 40 and above as well. And Manjimup had 43, Millian up 42, Mount William 56, Scott River 48, Thompson Brook 43. In the southern coastal region, there was a bit less, so it's 10 and above. Albany had 34, Amalup 10, Chain Beach 18, Denbarker 23, Denmark 35, Ingleborn 10, Kimberley 31, King River 23, Many Peaks 11, Narracup West 22, Stirling's North 12, and Stirling's South 14. Yeah, they beat you. Tamar 13, the Duke 10, and Wellstead had 12. In the central wheat belt, there was even less, so it's 5 and above. Amory Acres 7, Ardeth 12, Babbican 6, Ballardew 5, Beacon 6, Bencubbin 5, Beverley 8, Punteen West and Cadoo had 5, Kalgi 7, Cunderdin 9, Doongan Peak 5, Gemelling 8, Happy Valley 13, Duradine 5, Conongoring and Longforest 6, Meckering North, Monongarren, Mount Noddy, Mount Hardy, Muresk and Nanjean, and all recorded 5, Mount Westdale 16, Narrambeen 8, Northam 6, Quadney 7, Quereting 8, Southern Cross, Whale and Wyalke recorded 5 mils, Wongan Hill 6, York 7, and Yorker Kine had 11. And then in the Great Southern, it's 20 and above. Bonington North 20, Chamingup 21, Culford 31, Darkin 23, Franklin and Katanning 20 mils, Maradong 34, and Quail Up recorded 20. So a fair bit.
Richard, thank you for going through those details. 19 to 1. And we'll head off to Mouchet for the results of the cattle market just before 1. First, though, agriculture, outdoor workers and critical infrastructure, things like telecommunications, will all be negatively affected by climate change. Now, that's just some of the key findings in Australia's first national climate risk assessment released this morning by Climate Change and Energy Minister Chris Bowen. And it comes ahead of the government releasing new emissions targets for 2035, which are expected to be released in the coming days. Minister Bowen says the report has a clear warning for rural and regional communities.
This report is a reminder, if we needed one ever, that the cost of inaction will always outweigh the cost of action. But the report does make clear that some communities have a particular amount at stake. Those who live in the outer suburbs, those who live in rural and regional Australia, and those who live in northern Australia in particular. So anyone who says that climate change only matters in the inner cities should read this report. Natural disasters will increase most dramatically in Queensland, New South Wales, the ACT and Tasmania. And the amount spent on disaster recovery will increase dramatically over coming decades. People in northern Australia, including the Northern Territory, North Queensland and North WA, exposed to multiple worsening natural disaster risks. Extreme heat will impact on the productivity of outdoor workers, and the availability and affordability of insurance will worsen with flow-on impacts across the economy. Telecommunications assets are particularly exposed to extreme hazards. And very importantly, agriculture, farm productivity and farm profits have a lot at stake. Whether it be cropping, horticulture, cattle or sheep, fisheries, the report makes clear that Australians in regional areas will be big losers from unchecked climate change. We aren't working on reducing emissions for fun. The path to net zero is important. We're doing it because the impacts of our country are real. And importantly, the worst impacts are still avoidable. We are living climate change now. It's no longer a forecast, a projection, or a prediction. It is a lived reality. And it's too late to avoid any impacts. But it's not too late to avoid the worst of the impacts. Yes, Australia is a traditional fossil fuel economy. Absolutely. And we are in the middle of a very significant transition. But we also face that challenge from a position of strength because we have the best renewable resources in the world. We have 9 out of the 10 minerals under our soil that's necessary for a battery. We have the best solar and resources in the world and some of the best wind. So that gives us a remarkable opportunity.
Federal Climate Change and Energy Minister Chris Bowen, 16 to 1. Natalie Collard is the CEO of Farmers for Climate Action. She says the government needs to back up concerns about climate impacts on regional communities with policies that support agriculture into the future.
The National Climate Risk Assessment, or NCRA, has revealed that the cumulative loss of wealth in Australia due to reduced agricultural and labour productivity could reach $211 billion by 2050 and over $4.2 trillion by 2100 unless we act to protect farming jobs and industries today. So it's not just about economics, it's about livelihoods, families, and quite frankly, the future of regional Australia. And we represent 8,400 farmer members and over 80,000 community supporters. And the farmers are all regional. The community supporters are from regions, but also some are in cities. And we know that city people care about the future of regional Australia and want us to act and want government to act to support regions today.
Where are those losses expected to come from within agriculture? How is climate change going to have that impact on agricultural systems?
Well, we know every single region of Australia, every farming region is already impacted today. And what we're looking at are extremely concerning results. For example, in cities like Perth, manual labour could actually become incredibly dangerous for humans to do for 26 days a year by 2070. And that actually really threatens the productivity and job availability for farmers, contractors and labourers, the people who keep our food supplies and our country going. 93% of our farmers have already told us that they've been hit by extreme weather in the past 3 years. And 71% are already taking action to reduce emissions and investing in practical on-farm solutions. What we need now is government to match that ambition with adaptation, infrastructure investment and a really strong sector plan for land and agriculture. We're not here to admire the problem and to talk about how bad it's going to be. We knew that already. What we're hoping government will do with this new data is actually invest on climate smart farming adaptation, invest in regional infrastructure and have a really strong agriculture and land sector plan. But today, we need them to stick to closing coal and gas on time. We know that right now, coal and gas generate more than 5/8 of Australia's pollution, and that's why they must close on schedule. We're not asking government to do anything new. We've been asking the things that will solve this challenge are exactly what we've been asking for the 10 years that FCA has existed, and we need carrots, not sticks, to support people that are under pressure. It's got to acknowledge the impact of this information on people's well-being, their mental health, people that are already under a lot of pressure due to climate change already.
So the government will set emissions reduction commitments for 2035 this week. That's ahead of the United Nations Climate Summit coming up in about a month or so's time. What do your members want to see from these new climate targets? What commitment do you want to see from the federal government?
Stay the course and match it with investment to support us to get there sooner. That's in every single Australian's interest. And we've got a lot of the solutions. Back us in, back agriculture in, support regions. One of the key things is our members are very, very supportive of large-scale renewables, but that support is conditional. Every renewable project must be good for nature, good for farmers and good for communities. When done right, renewables deliver real opportunities for farmers, and we're talking $40,000 a year for hosting a wind turbine, and you can host 12 or more on a farm, and up to $1,500 per hectare hosting solar. And you're still grazing livestock, so you're doubling your income and profitability and productivity. If we have government support renewables done right, so investing in us to support regional communities to actually make sure renewables are right for them and set the priorities, not just host, but be partners in renewable energy hosting. We know that farmers and farming communities stand to gain $11.7 billion by 2050 just from hosting large-scale renewables, but it's got to be done right. So what we need is support for communities on the ground and support for farmers looking to host so they can make sure they dot the I's and cross the T's and are in a great position to have the best partnership they can have.
This year's United Nations Climate Summit will be held in Brazil, one of the world's largest food and fibre producers. Will Australian agriculture
Will Farmers for Climate Action be represented at that climate COP this year?
Absolutely, absolutely. FCA will definitely be represented, and we'll be looking to send sheep farmer, ultra-fine merino wool farmer, who also does agroforestry and has some great stories about how he's reduced emissions on farm while increasing a premium product of wool and increasing the value of that product. So it's a great news story, and we're also looking to support a First Nations food producer, Jocelyn King, to go and tell her incredible story and inspire others. I want to call out that the NCRA has identified some really concerning impacts on First Nations communities, and that includes a lot of farmers as well. So we say that that needs to be supported and supported well. But we also know that the National Farmers Federation is leading Australian agriculture's sustainability framework, and it's going to be really important that they're there and they're part of the solution, and they're looking to support and lead Australian agriculture to reduce emissions, to do our bit, to call out coal and gas to close on time, and to work with the rest of the world to solve what is a global problem that hits too close to home and needs all our attention and all our prioritisation.
Natalie Collard from Farmers for Climate Change speaking to Fiona Broom. 9 minutes to 1 o'clock. Tyson on the text says, give us a break. We've just had our wettest, coldest winter for a long time that no one predicted. They have no idea what will happen tomorrow, let alone in 50 years' time. Stop giving the woke airtime. The text is 0448 922 604. Dale Park is a beef cattle farmer from Badgingarra, 200 kilometres north of Perth. He's also a board member of the local WA group, Ag Zero. Dale, how do you think the WA farm sector will react to this climate report?
Well, all farmers. So while I was president of WA Farmers, I used to say that half our members believe that climate change is human-induced and is happening, and the other half didn't. But 100% of people are dealing with and adjusting to the changes that we're seeing. And then you've got other groups of people who are really grasping the, not the opportunity so much, but dealing with the variability and the changes that we're experiencing.
Here on the Country Hour, we get a lot of text messages, a lot of comments when our reporters are in the field denying that this is happening. They don't believe in climate change. They believe in climate variability, but really have an issue when it comes to climate change. What do you say to those farmers?
Well, yeah, I've only been collecting my rainfall detail data for the last 35 years at Badgingarra, and I know that it's getting drier. You know, the numbers don't lie. And if we're going to have climate variability, we should have variability both ways. So we should be having wetter years and drier years. Well, we've only been having drier years, but we've certainly been having hotter years. These are all things that people know about, but people don't want to admit. And humans are affecting the Earth far too quickly. We should be seeing these changes a lot slower than we are.
Is it the label that some farmers struggle with?
You don't want to be seen as woke, for a start. You don't, you don't want to be seen as being, you know, some sort of being influenced by the trend. There is a label problem, but we should put that aside and just deal with what we're dealing with. So this report, there are no surprises in the report. We've been told these things for the last 30 odd years, and the science on CO2 warming, for instance, is nearly 200 years old. So, yeah, get with the program.
What's practically going on farms in WA, even for those farmers? I mean, it's not just the farmers in your group who are being proactive and addressing the situation on your farms, but what else is going on here in WA that you've seen?
Well, if we just look at the changes that we've seen in cropping in the last 30-odd years, my father, who's still alive, will recognise it, but people, you know, my grandfather, for instance, would not recognise the way people do their cropping operations now. That's the sort of pace of change that everybody's dealing with. And it's not just Ag Zero. There's a lot of people out there dealing with it and looking for ways that they can best, you know, handle what's going to happen in the next 30 years. And the changes that are coming up are not so much rainfall changes, are probably going to be more temperature changes. So we're going to see more hotter days, very hot days in, say, September, which is hard to believe this September, but we're only 10 days or 12 days into it. But so we'll get hotter days in flowering, those sorts of things, which are going to affect, you know, the way we have crops, for instance.
Do you think this report will really open some eyes, farmers' eyes here in WA, or it's really going to be talking to the converted?
Yeah, I think it'll just be business as usual. Paul Simon once wrote that a man hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. And I think that's never been truer than today.
How do you respond to that?
With frustration, probably. But, yeah, it doesn't stop me talking about it.
Dale, great to talk to you. Thank you.
Good. Thanks, Belinda.
Dale Park, who farms at Badgingarra and is a board member of Ag Zero. On the text, Kate from Esperance says, can we all acknowledge that if the government wasn't running a taxpayer-funded Ponzi scheme when it comes to renewables, they would disappear very quickly? Governments love climate change as they can blame all their lack of planning on it. History will judge very harshly those who were either pawns or complicit in this World Economic Forum scam. And this from Ralph, this is nothing but climate change scaremongering propaganda to justify the net zero BS. End of story. Thanks, Ralph. 0448 922 604 to text through with your thoughts. Let's head to Mouchet now. And about 1,200 head of cattle sold at the market today. Terry Birkin has the prices for you. Hello, Terry.
Hi, Belinda. It was a similar sale volume-wise this week at Mouchet. However, steer and bull numbers fell away while cow supplies increased significantly. There were runs of local trade steers and heifers showing heavy weight and finish, selling at premium values, as well as good supplies of cows. On the pastoral side, again, drafts of large lines of cows and heifers were on offer, bringing top dollar from processors and feedlots, lifting the cow market 5 to 10 cents a kilo. The remainder of the sale was made up of lines of local feeder type weaners and yearlings and tail end pastoral calves. Local weaner steers were selling from 250 to 448 cents for bedded finished bodies, while weaner heifers gained 15 to 20 cents, making 208 to 404 cents a kilo. Local yearling steers under 330 kg sold from 304 to 390 cents, and heavier weights from 350 to 466 cents a kilo. Yearling heifers under 330 kg were selling from 220 to 358 cents, and with more weight and frame, sold to a top of 402 cents a kilo. Pastoral steer calves gained 30 to 40 cents, with young light steer calves starting from 198 to 350 cents, and bigger frame store steers sold to a top of 418 cents a kilo. Light frame pastoral heifers ranged from 150 to 304 cents, and bigger framed heifers sold to a top of 356 cents, lifting 10 cents a kilo. Pastoral grown steers sold from 298 to 380 cents, while local grown steers made 374 to 408 cents, and grown heifers collectively returned 282 to 402 cents a kilo. Light frame pastoral store cows sold from 80 cents to 146 cents, while bigger frame store cows were selling from 246 to 282 cents a kilo. Medium weight cows returned 282 to 338 cents, and heavy cows sold to a top of 360 cents a kilo. Shipping bulls sold from 240 to 334 cents, while local heavy bulls made 288 to 344 cents, and pastoral heavy bulls returned 220 to 350 cents a kilo. This is Terry Birkin for MLA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
Terry, thank you for going through those details. 1,201 in total, including 41 calves at Mouchet today. That was down on last week by 180. It's a minute away from the news at 1 o'clock. And Stephen Busso also wanted to chime in on the climate risk assessment that's just been released today by the Minister, Chris Bowen. And he says, hi, Belinda, I'm sorry, but Farmers for Climate Action are delusional. So get rid of gas and coal in Australia, but make overseas countries build wind turbines and solar panels using energy from coal and gas over there, please, says Steve. Thank you for that, Steve. And this text too. Richard, the Dockers won't win a flag until you read out all the rainfall amounts, 5 millimetres and over. And that's from Tom.
I've been blamed for a lot of things, but that's a fresh one. But if that is the secret to the Dockers winning a flag, I'm going to bore the pants off everyone and read out every single rainfall figure. Get ready. Get ready.
Oh, Tom, your wish has come true by the sounds of things. Good to talk to you today on the ABC right across Western Australia. Time for the latest news. 1 o'clock.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.